better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, October 29th, 2015, and this is episode 1668 of the Survival Podcast. A lot of times I do listener call shows on Thursday, but we have gotten kind of out of whack, so to speak, on some things with events and traveling and what have you. So I had Dorothy book two instead of one guest this week. So yesterday we talked to the author of Pivot Points, Paul T. Martin, on basic preparedness and spreading the preparedness message, and it was a fabulous interview. I had a lot of really great feedback on that, and it's kind of a back-to-basics episode in many ways, and that was really great. And today we're going to go into a totally different world. We haven't really done a podcast on true permaculture for a while, and that is what we're going to talk about today. But we're going to talk about it in a way that we don't usually talk about unless we're talking about my property. What I found in permaculture is, and farmsteading and homesteading, I don't care what you call it, but growing your own food, producing from your land, and being a good steward to it, call it whatever you want to, is that there's a tremendous amount of information and discussion on small properties, quarter acre and down, urban, suburban properties. And there's a whole bunch of discussion on big, broad acre properties, 30 acres, 40 acres, 100 acres, 1,000 acres. But a lot, you know, in that kind of 40 to 160 acre world of the old classic farm. But there's not a lot about mid-sized properties, 2 acres, 6 acres, 10 acres, that world. And to me, the bad thing about that is for many of us who say, you know what, I've had enough of city life, urban life, God forbid HOAs, I want out. I want out. But I don't want to move out in the middle of nowhere. I want to build a profitable business. And that means I need people around me to sell to. I need a market. I don't want to travel 2 hours to sell my product. I want people to come get it from me. I want that to be within reach. I don't want to be forever and a day away from my family. I want to be able to see them whenever I want to. Maybe I want to be far enough that somebody has to make an effort so they don't just drop by all the time. But when somebody wants to see me or I want to see them, I want to be able to do it. I want to be able to go to a show. I want to be able to go to a movie. I want to be able to go do whatever. When people make that choice, what they find is that land gets cheaper the further you go out. But no, you know, when you make that move, you don't want to move out into a suburb with quarter acre lots and all you've done is changed your geography a little bit. You want a piece of land. So you say, well, what can I afford? And it's those 2 to 10 acre parcels that most of us end up on. But we don't talk about developing to their full potential enough. Today we're going to do that with a guy named Rod Woods. We're going to talk about organics, compost tea, and permaculture on his 2.7 acre property in New Braunfels, Texas. Before we do that, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you by making sure the show is here for you Monday through Friday, 5 days a week. Sponsor of the day, number one today, bulkammo.com. When I need ammo and I want it in bulk, I go to bulkammo.com. Why? Because the name says what you're going to get. Ammo in bulk at great prices with lightning fast shipping. How fast is their shipping? It's almost like this. I've placed my order. I go on about my day and I hear, gee, who's that? It's the postman with my ammo. How did that happen? It's not quite that fast, but it feels that fast. I think for most of us to think, you know what I should do? I should run out to the, you know, sporting goods store or whatever and bulk up on ammo this week. By the time you got around to doing it, it could be sitting on your doorstep. That's how quick their shipping is. They have all of the common calibers, great pricing, excellent service, and they're a long-term sponsor. They've been with us for, I think, 4 years now. So when you need ammo and you need it in bulk, get on over to Bulk Ammo. Remember, ammo is one of the three components to the triangle of gun operator effectiveness. You've got to have the weapon. You go to a gunfight without a gun, you got a problem. You, the operator, needs training. But even with a good operator and a good firearm, without the ammo, man, that's the terminal tackle, as we say in fishing. You've got to have the ammo to put food on the table, to protect life and property, and to train effectively. Check out bulkammo.com today. And remember, they do a discount for members of the Support Brigade. Just check the benefits section of your MSB for more information on that. Next up today, sponsor of the day number two, Sawtooth Tactical. You'll find them over at sawtac.com. You'll get all the stuff you need to live that tactical lifestyle if you get on over to Sawtac. Veteran-owned, veteran-operated, and nestled in the wilderness of the Sawtooth Mountains. That's why they call them Sawtac. And when I say everything, I mean everything from the awesome Manly Titanium Spork, Maxpedition Bags, Magpul Magazines, SOE Tactical Gear, and everything else you can think of. If it's tactical, they have it at Sawtooth Tactical. Remember the website again, www.sawtac.com, and they also do a discount for members of the Support Brigade. So if you're a member and you're going to get some tactical material from Sawtac, get into your MSB account, click on benefits, and look up Sawtac and get that discount. Again, a veteran-owned, veteran-operated company nestled in the Sawtooth Wilderness of Idaho, sawtac.com. Next up, let's take a look at the year that was the episode. The year is 1668 because the episode is 1668. I have Portugal is Portugal again. I also have Newton's latest accomplishment reflects well on him. And I have United by Consent, Leviathan and the Declaration of Independence. Really, really interesting one there. But I'm going to read Newton's latest accomplishment reflects well on him because I have a similar take to Alex. And I sometimes like to take something where I have a totally different take, totally different way of seeing it. Sometimes I like to point out, yeah, that's what I think too. So here you go. Isaac Newton builds the first reflector telescope. It will be forever known as the Newtonian reflector. It uses a concave mirror at the bottom of a long tube to capture light. The light then bounces back up the tube and focuses on a smaller mirror near the top. The light is then directed at a right angle toward the eye. It makes sky viewing a lot more comfortable and will make it possible for very large collection mirrors. Virtually all modern telescopes, including the Hubble Space Telescope, are variations of the Newtonian reflector invented this year. Yeah, before I read Alex's take, just think about that for a second. The design that Isaac Newton came up with and first made public in 1668 is the same design that's floating in orbit around the Earth looking at the furthest reaches of our cosmos in 2015. It humbles our arrogance a little bit to realize that brilliance is not a modern invention. Anyway, my take by Alex Shrug, grinding a mirror for a Newtonian reflector by hand is within the capability of almost anyone over the age of 14. Alex, I'm not sure why you picked 14 for the number, but okay. However, it's tedious work, so the mirrors are usually made by grinding machines. Since I once lived near Mead Instruments in Irvine, California, I dropped by and bought a 6-inch primary mirror already made. I also used some leftover tubing from a construction site and built a reasonably sturdy tripod from scraps of wood. It still works. I had dreamed of building such an instrument since I was a little boy after my neighbor let me look at the moon through a tiny telescope. It popped up on the hood of his car. I kept putting it off until I just decided to make it happen. I got the job done. The next thing on my bucket list was building my own mini computer. No kit, no microchips, straight TTL logic, and a wire wrapper. My experience with a telescope taught me not to put things off until I have time. I never have time. I just have to make it happen one step at a time or decide I don't want it bad enough and quit crying about it. And yes, the mini computer worked. I failed the first time, but I didn't give up. I learned from my mistakes and I kept at it. Yeah, I have really been into the theme lately of get shit done. And here's the reality. You have time to do anything you want to do, but you do not have time to do everything that you want to do. Your mind, because you are a brilliant individual, we all are. We are all brilliant. None of us are stupid. Einstein said, if you judged a fish on its ability to climb a tree, it would live its entire life believing itself to be stupid. We all have brilliance, and that brilliance allows us to dream of so many things. People often ask, those of us that get a lot of shit done, how do you do it? We pick and choose. We pick and choose the things that are the most important to us, and we feel will give the greatest contribution to others. And then we focus on those and accept the things we can't do, instead of worrying about all the things we want to do and not getting anything done. My call to you today, guys, is get shit done. Somebody recently sent me a coffee cup, a little thing with their company name on it, and said that, you know, they got that done. They got a business started because of what we talk about here on the air. But you know what the cup really was? It just said, get shit done, and it had a check mark. I'm drinking coffee out of it right now. I'll be using that one a lot. Those of you who come in here in a couple weeks to our workshop in November, you'll probably see me walking around with it. It's a great daily reminder. And yesterday I went outside with it, and I was letting the ducks out of their coop. And like I do, I lose my coffee cup. Like once a day, I lose a coffee cup. I find that cup the next day and lose another one. It's just how it is. And so I set it up on the fence post to open the gate and let the ducks out. I went in to do something, and I turned around and went back out and didn't realize it was there, and realized, like, heck on it, I've lost my coffee cup again. And I realized there must still be good coffee in there, because I can still taste coffee. You know, after you've had a sip of coffee and it was hot and it's kind of sticks around for a while, it's like, it's not far. I turn around and look at the post, and it's sitting up there, profiled by the blue morning sky, and it says, get shit done, check mark. And I looked around and I thought, you know what? Check mark indeed. Birds fed, sprouts done, land walked, decisions made about the next steps, off to do a podcast, get shit done. My take. By Jack Spearco. Next up, do consider joining the Member Support Brigade. We can help you get shit done with the Member Support Brigade, because there's a lot of stuff that you want to invest in for your homestead and your lifestyle and your prepping. And we get you discounts on just about anything you can think of, from the tactical to the practical at the MSB. In fact, just yesterday I brought on a great new partner who does silver. And silver bullion, yes, but also really cool older silver coins and affordable stuff. Right? Not the cased and slab stuff that's like MS69, there's only three in the world, $9 million, but cool stuff to add to your personal collections and to spread the word about liberty and freedom and show our kids what it looked like when our money had symbols of liberty on it versus faces of politicians. How about that? You can get 10% off all that stuff at SchaeferSelect.com. And that's because you're an MSB member. If you're not an MSB member, you can't get it. And what am I doing right now? I'm running a 24-hour sale, and I decided to be fair, since I announced it yesterday on the air, 24 hours would be till the end of the day. So it's really like 30 hours or something like that since I announced it. So you still have the rest of the day to use discount code 24hours, 24, H-O-U-R-S, when you sign up for MSB and get your first year of MSB for $30 if you are not already a member. And you should be, because you're listening to this show and you like the work we do. So check it out. Go to survivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. With that, I'm ready to get our special guest on the line and start talking about getting shit done. His name is Rod Woods. He's a great guy. I know he's a great guy because, well, he's part of the Survival Podcast audience. And all of you guys are awesome. He's been listening for over 2 years. He's a cool guy. He's into permaculture and metal, like Slayer, Pantera, and Megadeth. He's going to be on with us right now. And if you go to the survivalpodcast.com, look this episode up, you'll see him in all his Slayer glory standing in front of a field of sunflowers. And with that, hey, Rod, man, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Hey, Jack.
Hey, man, I'm glad to have you. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, I'm glad to have you on. Real quick, I always like to ask guests before we get into the topic at hand, which today is going to be basically permaculture and compost tea on mid-size acreage. More or less, how did you get into doing this in the first place? Kind of lets the audience kind of connect with you if they've not ever heard from you before. So, you know, did you grow up doing this, or did you take that wonky path like many of us did?
Oh yeah, I took the wonky path here. Let me preface it with, I was born in Useless, Texas.
Okay.
which AKA is also known as Euless. And the reason I call it Useless is because of just basically me and my, you know, how I came to be, basically, in that, you know, I got through, my wonky path was stoned and drunk.
Okay.
is how I got to where I am. Now, I don't recommend that for anybody. Trust me. But that's where it is. And a similarity or coincidence, I guess, is that I spent like the first 5 years of my life in Azle, which is in Boyd, which is right by where you're at.
Yeah, Boyd and Byer. The Useless thing is a local joke. Like if you're from Dallas-Fort Worth, you know the joke.
Yeah, exactly. If you're from the HEB area, which is Hearst, Euless, Bedford, you know that it's Euless. But yeah, that's the joke there. And basically, you know, the growing thing, I got into gardening about 20 years ago and got into organics. Down here in San Antonio, there's a radio guy by the name of Bob Webster, who's our local garden guru. He's real big in organics. And we can go into that more as we talk. And, you know, organics just seemed to be the way to go. And then I ended up getting some property, this 3 acres, with the idea of I wanted to grow stuff. Excuse me. And I knew I wanted to grow stuff. I just didn't really know how and what. I knew I wanted to grow fruit trees, da-da-da-da-da. And then I ended up finding your podcast about, well, 2 years ago now, 7 years into owning this property, 8 years into owning this property. And it just, the permaculture was the piece of the puzzle that I had been missing the whole time. It just made total sense. I mean, I'm sitting out here on basically an old hay field up on a hill, and it's, you know, clay soil, but not the black gumbo clay. I'm on the yellow caliche clay. And I was like, holy, wait a minute. This permaculture stuff is, that's what I need to be doing. You know, water reclamation, making the water work for you, stay on the property as long as you can. I've got a slope that I've done over the years. I worked at a treatment center, and I would bring home all of the leaves from this treatment center. You know, when the yard guys would bring them and pack them up, I'd bring my trailer in, load them up, and I would dump them down there. And not knowing what I was doing, I was actually dumping them on contour just because it made sense. You know, the water's flowing this way. I want to restrain this water. You know, this would be the way to do it. Not knowing what I was doing, but that's what I did. I don't know how much you really want me to go into my past, but that's kind of where it is as to where, you know, how I got to where I'm at now, simply.
And you decided kind of in the beginning to go with an organic approach. What kind of drove that for you?
Here's my thinking with organics, and the simplest way that I can put it, you can't mess up with organics. I can go and dump a gallon of seaweed on a tree, and it ain't going to hurt it. If I go dump a gallon of some other, you know, high potency chemical fertilizer on something, I'm going to hurt it, not to count what it's going to do to me. And like I said with Bob Webster here in San Antonio and talking about organics and listening to him and following him regularly, and also, you know, it gets into Malcolm Beck, who is kind of the godfather of this area of compost and the organic method. You know, people like John Jomgold, who is the Austin gardening guru. He has a radio show in Austin, and he learned from Malcolm Beck. Howard Garrett, I'm sure you know of up in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Yeah.
Howard Garrett learned from Malcolm Beck. You know, he's the guy that in, you know, the late or early 60s and, you know, late 60s, early 70s was doing this organic thing. And basically what he started off doing was, yeah, his old school, what his parents had told him and grandfather told him about farming, you know, and paying attention to nature. And he started, you know, growing his garden with compost. Well, he started making compost, and his garden grew really good, and people were buying his vegetables and his produce. And it was, you know, then they got going, hey, how are you doing this? Well, it's that black mound of stuff over there. Well, you know, and he had a bunch of it. And they're like, well, would you sell me some of that? So he flipped his, you know, organic growing produce business into a compost business, which it turned into being a company called Gardenville, which anybody in South Texas knows Gardenville, which ultimately got out by Texas Disposal Systems here in South Texas. That's who he sold to a few years ago. And, you know, that's where Malcolm, that's the organic approach down here with Malcolm Beck. And he's got several books. Malcolm Beck is a heck of a guy. Super nice. I mean, I've met him. I just walked up to him, and it's like you know him. And I don't want to speak of how he's doing right now because I don't think he's doing real good. I saw him a few months ago at Alzavar Shrine, and he was doing pretty good. But I don't know that he's in real good health here lately. But he's got some books, a book called Lessons in Nature, the Texas Bug Book, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, which is written and co-authored by Howard Garrett. He's got another book called The Secret Life of Compost. But Malcolm's approach to things are real simple. It's kind of like sitting down with your grandfather. You know, and thinking of listening to you and your relationship that you had with your grandfather over the years that you've talked on your podcast, Malcolm Beck was kind of like the grandfather that I didn't have. And talking to him, listening to him, and reading his books, he kind of, you know, he led me to the simple stuff. You know, like one of the things that I know he talks about is that how he noticed as a kid that the seeds germinated where the cows walked through. Where the cow had pushed that seed down in the ground, that seed would germinate better than the seed that was just sitting on the ground. You know, the simple stuff, the simple basic stuff that 200 years ago was common knowledge, just like you speak of, and I relate to that so much because of listening to Malcolm. When you speak of it, because of listening to Malcolm, because it's the same sort of stuff that he preaches. It's the stuff that, you know, 200 years ago, everybody knew this. This is just what we did. And nowadays, it's like, well, what is it? What are you talking about? Compost and mixing up compost and you step on a seed, push it, and it grows better? What are you talking about? But, you know, and, you know, that's just the sort of stuff that Malcolm does. And he talks about.
Yeah. And, you know, like, no, definitely. And I mean, I think that there's a lot going on there. I mean, one of the big things that you have really embraced isn't just composting, but compost teas. In fact, you say that there's a secret to it. What do you mean by that?
The secret to compost tea is there is no secret. Well, okay, let me reiterate that. Maybe there is. The secret to compost, the secret, in my opinion, to compost tea is diversity. And let me qualify this. I have taken Elaine Ingram's course on brewing compost tea. I have read her book on her manual on brewing compost tea. I've studied some of the soil food web information that she has out that I've been able to acquire cheaply, because none of Elaine Ingram's stuff is cheap.
Yeah.
If anybody that's pursued that knows, it's just not cheap. And I will toot my horn about that compost tea conference. Everybody showed up, or a bunch of us showed up with brewers and brewed our tea. And it supposedly wasn't a tea off, because Malcolm and Bruce Dooley the year before had kind of sort of cheated, because they used well water. So it had a whole lot of microbes in it versus everybody else's water. And so they didn't say it was a tea off. A few months after that conference, I ran into a lady at the hydroponic store who was buying a meter that turned out worked for the lab, the soil food lab in Austin, and got to speaking to her. And turns out that she was at that conference and was the one that brought back and tested all of the samples. And I said, well, so who's ended up being the best? And she said it was that Vortex brewer. I said, oh, really? Well, that's nice to know. So the Vortex brewer was my brewer. That was me.
Wow.
And I had no idea of it. I just happened to find out by luck, being at the right place at the right time, that I actually brewed the best tea there that weekend. So I have a little bit of experience with brewing compost tea and some good luck at it. I guess I don't want to say luck. It's just some experience at it. But what I would say back to your original question is the secret of it is diversity in your compost.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? Because, like, when I listen to Elaine, I think, okay, I'm listening to one of the most brilliant people on planet Earth. But on some levels, I also think to myself, does this really directly apply to me? Because, I mean, this is a woman that'll say, well, I'll go out to a place where they're growing strawberries, and I'll brew a tea that's specific to, you know, making large-scale strawberry production better. And I'm thinking, but I want to grow 400 things. And sometimes I think that we can overcomplicate things. And, you know, is your approach that scientific like she does? Or is it more, hey, look, we know what works, so let's just do that and do it right?
I'm with you on it. Let's just do what works. Let's do it right. Not all of us have. I mean, when you talk about Elaine Ingram being a smart lady, you are not kidding.
No.
I mean, yes, brilliant is the word for it. You're not joking. If you've met her, you know. I mean, when it comes to compost or when it comes to soil microbes, she is the beginning and end all that I can think of in this country, period. I mean, really, she knows what's going on. And she gets so specific in the things. And I saw the pictures that these ladies had on their computers of the microbes. My microscope doesn't look like that, man. I'm talking crazy looking bugs and really cool looking colors and stuff. And it's like, I don't know how they did that. You know, and it was really cool looking. But that's not what it looks like on my microscope. And I've looked at hundreds of batches of compost tea. I started a compost tea business for a few years that I was, you know, working at getting going, and just never really panned out to the expectations that I had for it. Every single batch of tea that left this house got looked underneath a microscope. Every single batch. You know, and every single batch that I brew, I look at it underneath the microscope. Just because I want to see, I want to make sure they're there. And I know what I'm looking for. I look for the activity. I don't look to, oh, that's an amoeba, or that's a nematode, or that's a protozoan, and that's bacteria. I look, there's all kinds of little critters moving around up in there. Okay, that's cool. You know, they're there. I know they're there. Now, exactly what they are, I can't tell you. And I mean, I'm sure I could if I had a better microscope and really wanted to. I mean, I recognize some of them. I mean, a nematode, they're pretty pronounced. They're larger, you know, back to our, a larger microbe on the scale of microbes. And if you got them in there, you can definitely see them. And they're wild-looking critters. You know, basically, my understanding is the alien from the Alien movies was taken from a nematode. If you really look at the front of a nematode and how wicked evil it looks, well, that's how a nematode looks, is it like the alien from the movie. But
real quick, though, she talks a lot about, like, you don't want this and you don't want that. Have you ever brewed a batch and then looked at it and said, okay, I'm not using that, that there's something really, really wrong with it? Because, I mean, I don't know. I've made a whole lot of compost tea in my life, and up until I even heard of Elaine, I never looked at anything under a microscope, and I used a lot of it, and I never really had bad results. I always had pretty good results from what I did. And, you know, Mike Vertrees has gotten deep into her stuff, and he's always told me, but you can do better. And I don't deny that, but I also think maybe that we worry too much.
I'm with you.
Okay.
I'm totally with you. I was concerned, actually, in speaking to you in this regards, because of what Mike is doing. I didn't know which side you were going to lean. But I'm definitely leaning towards the side that you speak of. Is it... Here's the thing. You can take a batch of compost tea and put the exact same thing in it, the exact same water, the exact same compost, the exact same inoculants as far as seaweed, molasses, and whatever else you want to put in there, and brew it for the exact same time, and it will never look exactly the same.
Hmm.
You want to know why that is?
Because life does what it wants to, I guess. I mean, that's a big
part
of it. Right?
I'll give you that. Life's going to do what it's going to do. It's based on barometric pressure. It's based on temperature. It's based on humidity. You know, it's based on the winds as to what is going to actually, you know, grow inside that compost tea. You know, especially if you're brewing it outside. Because I've brewed for years and years and years, and it's always different, a little bit different. For some reason, you know, sometimes there'll be more bacterial rods than other times. I'm brewing out of the same batch of compost. You know, maybe it was the, you know, I got a different corner of the compost pile this time. You know, just, there's just so many variables. I don't know how in the world that she is able to get so precise with it, other than the fact that she really is, you know, she really is that smart, and I agree that she is, but it's beyond me as to how she figures that out.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, her husband's a nematologist. I didn't know that there was such a thing as a nematologist,
right,
before I heard of Elaine Ingham. And I, again, I'm coming down on the same side you are, but I'm not at all taking away from anything that people do at that level. I'm just saying that level's not for everybody. Like, there's a practical application that's at, you know, our level. We put some really great compost and we strain it through and we aerate it and we put it on plants and son of a gun, they grow really good. And I'm okay with that, right?
Yep. You know, as long as when you brew a batch of tea, it doesn't smell bad.
Yeah.
I've only brewed one batch that smelled bad, that really had a really rancid, and you know it when you do it. You come out the next morning or the next day and you go, whoa, this ain't right. Yeah. And that be done with. You know, you're not going to put that on anybody. Now, I went and put it back in my compost pile, so whatever was alive in there, you know, that was decent could be there. Because basically I overfed it with molasses, you know, and just overcooked it. The bacteria. And that's generally what happens. If you put too much molasses in there, or too much sugar in there, whatever sugar substance you're using in brewing, and it just overcooks the bacteria. You know, one of the things that's always stuck out in my head in brewing compost tea is that if you start off with 10 bacteria in a batch of compost tea, once it starts aerating, that bacteria multiplies every 15 minutes.
Mm.
So in 15 minutes, you went from 10 to 20. And then you get into from 20 to 40.
80, 160.
Yeah.
And it just, there's an exponential curve there.
Yes, and it's exponential and it's fast, so you're looking at 24 hours. So you're breeding these things. Plus you're aerating the water. There's just a lot of benefits to it. When you get into, the brewer itself, and that was, in the beginning was always the big issue was the brewer. What brewer are you going to use? And, for people in their yards, those 5-gallon buckets with a couple of air stones, they're good little brewers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's another place where I think people have gotten a little bit too concerned. I've really seriously considered investing in a Vortex brewer, and eventually I probably will. But what I use right now is I make a bunch at a time, and I use a 32-gallon tough grade garbage can, and I use a great big round air stone. I'm talking like a 6-inch round air stone and a commercial quality aquarium pump. And one of the objections I've heard from the really scientific people is you'll never get that stone clean. There'll be things growing in there that you don't want to grow in there. And I'm like, I got a brew kettle that boils a gallon of water in freaking 5 minutes. And I throw that stone in there, and I don't know what's in there, but I know one thing. After it's been in boiling water for a couple minutes, it's dead. And there's just nothing living in there at that point. And, if it eventually wears out, the stone costs like $10. I'll throw it away, and Amazon Prime will send me a new one for $10, shipping included. I mean, I think we can get too concerned.
I'm totally with you on that. One of the things is definitely in regards to, because they really, Elaine and a lot of these people get real hardcore into the cleaning. Clean, 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 clean. Everything's got to be, like super sterilized to the hospital grade almost. Like. And it's like some of the best tea that I make and the most fungal-based tea that I've ever brewed is when I was brewing tea, when I was working or selling it on the weekends. And I would brew a batch for, that would be ready for Saturday. And then I would just drain that batch off, fill it back up with water, leaving in some of the residual that was there, not doing a major cleaning, filling that back up, putting in more compost, more inoculants, aerating it, and then spraying it Sunday, then doing another batch for me on Monday would be my batch. And that batch was the best batch of the three batches. And if you were to do a super cleaning in between every single one of those brews, I would have never got to that third brew. It wouldn't have happened because of the biofilm. Oh my God, the biofilm. Oh dude. And I'm serious. And here's the thing, and Elaine will tell you, in this area of the country, one of the main things that we need is fungus. Our soils are depleted in fungus.
Big time. You're south of me. It just gets worse from here, right? I mean, I know what you're saying.
And so, to get a good fungal-based tea, you can't get it in 24 hours. Mm. And that's according to Elaine Ingham. You need a longer brew time for the fungus.
Gotcha.
And that's part of the reason why I was doing that. Plus, I was just playing around, seeing what it did. And I knew I wasn't brewing anything bad. And I just, when I went from, the Saturday to the Sunday and went, hey, this looks a whole lot better. And then I went to Monday and went, holy crud, dude, what the heck are these people talking about? It's got to be totally cleaned out in between every freaking brew.
Yeah.
I think they're missing some stuff here, because it was not only the same things that I saw plus, but then there were other things. And then the fungus started to appear.
Gotcha.
And
it would make sense. That's part of why it's hard to move to fungal domination, and I think most people don't even get fungal domination. You get the 1-to-1, man. You're fungal dominated. They grow, the fungi grow slower. So since they grow slower, they need more time to take up residence, so to speak.
Yep, they do. They definitely do. And as far as your Vortex brewer, I got a story as far as where I got mine from.
Okay.
You've interviewed Evan.
Yeah, he's great. And I need to get him back, honestly.
And I will actually like to talk about Secrets of the Soil at some point in this little interview.
That's where we're going next.
If we get to that. But here's how I got my Vortex brewer. I played around with all these different types of brewers and what I could afford. I always operate on, I'm white trash, poor budget, man. That's where I'm at. I want to do stuff cheap. So I was trying all these different brewers as best I could to my abilities until I came across Natural Science Organics, which is Steve Storch. which is who Evan is associated with. I'm not for certain, but I think Evan learned from Storch. And I got on his website and saw what he was doing. It was biodynamics and stuff. And it's like, whoa, this stuff is weird. And it gets kind of crazy and out there. But this brewer looked cool. You know, air is what we want in a brewer. And air is what is causing this vortex. So the whole thing is being, you know, is being generated or, you know, created by air. This just made sense to me. And that's the, and I made that brewer and called up Steve Storch and asked him how to use it. I thought that was funny. And he talked to me.
That's cool.
Steve Storch is, he's in Long Island, New York, and he talked to me. And I spent hours talking to him about how to use that brewer. And he's the one that told me what to do before I went to that compost tea conference. One of the funny things that happened during that tea conference is there was the guy there promoting one of his, one of those super cool, all stainless steel air, you know, regenerative pumps that blows into the IBC tote. And it's $1,500 just for the, you know, the pump and all this other stuff. Like, what in the world? And he kept going, coming around with an air meter, an O2 meter to my brewer. And he kept searching. He's, I walked up to him because he's, this dude's got this thing stuck in my brewer. And I'm like, hey man, what are you doing? You know, I'm checking the O2 levels. I said, well, really? Well, how are they? He said, well, they're actually pretty good, but I know there's a void in here somewhere. I said, really? There's a void somewhere, huh? I said, well, hey, do me a favor. This is my brewer. When you find it, would you let me know where it is? Oh, this is your brewer? I said, yeah, man, this is my brewer. But it's cool. Just let me know when you find it. He never came back to me where he found that. How is he going to find a void in water that is being stirred by air, creating a vortex? You're not going to do it.
I think
he never.
That's another example of people thinking too hard and wanting to be right. Maybe I don't know.
Well, he was. Yeah, I think he was looking for a way to put the brewer down. I guess to promote his is my assumption.
Yeah.
Is my
assumption. There's just a type of perception bias there, right? I mean,
yeah. And I was cool with him. I told you what, when I said what I said to him, because he didn't know who I was when I walked up there. And I was just curious as to what he was doing. And I just kind of played him, you know, like, what the heck are you doing? And then I told him, hey, that's my brewer you're putting that thing in, so I'd like to know if you find one. And I went back and told Storch that, and Storch just laughed. And he goes, yeah, you're right. Let him tell you, let him show you where it's at, because he ain't going to find one, I'll guarantee you. You know, this is the type of deal. But no, Storch is a really good guy, and in making a biodynamic brewer or a vortex brewer, you can take what you've already got and make a vortex brewer. All it is a matter of plumbing it, you know, putting a drain in it with and teeing it off and putting the uplifts and then dropping air stones into both those uplifts, and you've got to buy. You have a vortex brewer. A couple of years ago when I first started listening to your podcast, I emailed you something when you talked about wanting to build a vortex brewer and said, basically, you know, just let me know if you want help. I can guide you in it if you want.
I don't get back to a lot of people, but somewhere in the cell back door, I actually remember that email. I do remember you emailing me. Not verbatim what you said, but you know, that one does ring true. I remember you doing that.
Yeah, it was just, you know, I wasn't, you know, thinking that you would actually get back to me, but it's like, hey, if you're interested, you know, dude, you know, go ahead, you know, call me up. I'll be more than happy to walk you through it. I mean, how can I not do that when the guy that I copied it from told me how to use the thing?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I promised Storch that I would never build a brewer and sell those brewers, and I have not done it. Now, have people that I have built them for, a couple of friends of mine, actually one in particular that owns a hydroponic store, he has them for sale in his shop, but I didn't build it for him to sell. I built it for him at his house, and I didn't even charge him to build it. I built it because he's a friend of mine. You know, when he wanted to pay me money, I said, no, dude, we're friends, and that's it. Let's just leave it at that. You know, but you can walk in his store right now and there's a double air uplift brewers for sale. And he's a good guy. Don't get me wrong. You know, great guy. I've learned so much from hanging out at hydroponic stores. If people want to mess with compost tea, I strongly recommend going to the hydroponic store and looking at their liquid, you know, solutions as inoculants, because there's all kinds of cool stuff that you can play around with that's organic in the hydroponic store to add to your compost tea to play with it.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Let's move on to soil, though, because you, like me, say, I don't really grow plants, I grow soil. You want to talk about that for a bit?
That's exactly what we're doing. And that's another thing that I got from Malcolm Beck. It's not about growing your plants. If you do not have microbes and fungus in the soil, or actually, in particular, fungus, if you do not have fungus in your soil, you cannot grow plants. Plants will not grow. Period. You have to have some kind of fungus. Even if you don't think that it's there, you have to have it. So I learned a long time ago with this organic approach is that I'm growing soil. I'm growing dirt. You know, we talk about a dirt farmer back in the day. Well, I'm a dirt farmer today, and a dirt farmer today is growing dirt, which is, you know, increasing my bioflora in the soil, you know, my microbe count in the soil, you know, the humus in the soil, the minerals, making sure the minerals are in the soil. Is, you know, that's what growing soil is about. You know, and if you want to step in to the biodynamic approach, it gets pretty weird. You know, when you start burying the horns back in the back and at the winter equinox or spring equinox, and then digging them out in the spring equinox. And I've done it, and there's some cool looking fungus up in there. You know, you bury those horns with the cow manure in them. But, you know, yes, it's definitely about growing soil more than it is about growing the plants. It's if it's not in the soil, it ain't going to be in your plant. As simple as that.
Definitely.
You know.
I mean,
and,
go ahead.
Oh, no. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you would think that by now that would be common knowledge, that if you just think about a plant and you realize that there's some exceptions to this. Last time I said this, I got attacked by somebody who says, well, it's not true of redwood trees. It's like, please, let's talk about averages here. But a plant on average that's healthy anyway has an equivalent biomass under the soil as it does above the soil.
Exactly.
And if we don't address the environment that half of the plant is in, it seems completely and wholly unreasonable to expect that the part above the soil would be healthy.
Exactly. There's a whole synergistic system, as the soil food web, you know, talks about. And it's more so in the ground than it is above the ground. You know, there's, you know, how many billions of microbes in, you know, a square foot of soil. If you don't have them there, that soil is dead and you can't grow in it. So it's got to be there. I mean, you can do the chemical thing where you're force feeding a plant, which is basically like putting a plant on steroids. That just reminded me of my organic analogy versus the chemical analogy. Basically, organics is feeding things naturally, eating healthy, doing what you can to stay healthy through, you know, natural foods. And chemical fertilizer is like being on drugs, man. And, you know, once you get hooked on a drug, you got to have more and more and more of that drug to keep that high. It's the same thing with plants. And it's what they're finding out with the Roundup and with their chemical fertilizers is that they got to keep adding more and more and more of it to get the same growth that they got the year before. Because they are killing this. Well, you know, chemical fertilizers don't kill off all of your soil microbes immediately, but they continually kill it off and continually kill it off and continually kill it off, which means they've got to add more and more and more of the chemical to get what they got last year. It's just the way that it is. You know, I talked about secrets of the soil, and we were going to get into that at some point. I don't know if that's now or it's going to be now.
Yeah, it was
now. One of the interesting things about secrets of the soil, first off, if you haven't read the book, it's $10. And it's when you get it, you'll be amazed that it was only a $10 book because it's like 2 inches thick and it's a hardcover. And I know when I bought mine, it was like nine something delivered to my door. And the wealth of information in this book is just unbelievable. Yes, it gets out there into let's play music for our plants and they're happy sort of stuff. It's like, okay, dude, that's a little trippy, but hey, if it works for you, that's cool, man.
Yeah.
But one of the things about it is that there were people opposed to chemical fertilizers in the late 1800s.
Yes.
From a, you know, from this book. And in my narrow-minded, you know, day state that I have spent most of my life in, I always thought that the hippie movement started in the 60s and 70s, and that's where organics came from. I'm talking, yeah. It's been around for 100 years. They've been opposed to this stuff. And that's one of the really interesting facts that I found in that book that I didn't know. I didn't know in the 1870s that there were people opposed to chemical fertilizers and were preaching about the fact that these are not going to be good for your plants and not going to be good for the health of the soil, which is not going to be good for the health of the planet, a long time ago. And that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I remember when I first found out about that, I think I was watching some sort of a documentary on YouTube or something. And I think it was actually from BBC. And I don't know about you, but when I found that out, it actually, you know, I was already sold, but it kind of really like made me more convicted about, you know, realizing how important this was. Like the fact that people could see it then, like it was as soon as I can't remember the doctor's name, the scientist that figured out, okay, we can pour acid on a rock and we can get the stuff off of it. Almost as soon as that happened, there were people that said, this is a bad idea. And I don't know, like if people like that get painted as being, you know, a fearing change or whatever. You made a Wayne's World reference to me when we were talking before we got on. You know, we fear change. But I think to me that actually said, okay, these people immediately knew this was wrong. And now we can look back over 100 years and go, yeah, they were right. And that just kind of drove it home for me and made me look at it differently.
Well, if you really want to get into it, we can spin this off into all kinds of directions. And because it ends up being money is what ends up being the driving force behind it. Because after World War II, that's when chemical fertilizers really got big because chemical companies, you know, the munitions manufacturers needed something to do with their excess nitrates from making bombs. And they found out there's money to be made in putting it in fertilizers. And that spins off to where we know it goes into Monsanto's and these god awful, you know, companies that are just out destroying the world to make a buck.
Well, I mean, you hear people all the time on the, you know, one side of permaculture and organics saying, you know, if we ever don't have the natural gas to get these nitrates from, you know, we'll be screwed. So we need to make sure we're doing this naturally now. And what never kind of gets pointed out is what you just said. That's not like we get it from gas reserves and what have you. It's a waste product otherwise. If they didn't repackage it into fertilizer and sell it to farmers to put on the ground and they just dumped it somewhere, it would be considered a toxic waste and they would be fined for it. And I don't think people actually have, in large, made that connection yet.
Nope. And, what it boils down to in the blunt terms, it's just how stupid we are. I mean, it really does. How stupid are we? You know, they've been preaching against this for over 100 years. Granted, it was a very few at the beginning, I'm sure. And we still ain't got it yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's still, that's what is primarily promoted on TV, at Home Depot, and on the radio are chemical fertilizers, and we still ain't got it. You know, like we talk, you know, you talk a lot about growing that green yard, woo-hoo-hoo, you know, that does what for you? What does it do?
Well, you can pay somebody again next year to come make sure it stays that way. That's what you get. And your neighbor goes, oh, look at my neighbor's yard. It's awesome. I want my yard to be like that. And that's what we've become in this country is a whole bunch of people trying to make other people want to be like us instead of worrying about trying to be the way we want to be.
And how far does the brainwashing really go? You're good at that. You can delve into a lot of areas. But, you know, really, how far does a brainwashing go? How brainwashed are we? You know, people back in the day, I'll never take the mark of the beast. I'd never take the mark of the beast. That could never happen. I got news for you. All of us carry a cell phone that has a GPS tracker in it. Guess what that is? That's the mark of the beast.
I guess it qualifies under the logistical definition for sure. And it is ironic that I guess it's held in the right hand and put up to the head. But I'll let that
it's
go.
A tool.
That's
it's
not
a
my
tool.
World. But
hey, and not only do we carry it, we pay for it.
Yeah.
And we pay for the dang thing.
And it's only kind of freaky. Like, so it enables commerce, and the day is probably coming when you won't be able to buy or sell without one. That would be. All right, so let's not.
I know. Let's not go too far into George. Just not go too far into George Orwell.
Yeah, let's go back to permaculture, right? Because you say permaculture is the missing link, and what I've seen, you mentioned a lot of these guys that have been around a long time, like Howard Garrett. So I've been introduced remotely to Howard Garrett several times. He's never gotten back to me. And I think it's because he has a pretty bad taste in his mouth for permaculture. And I think it's because of purple breeders that say organic sucks, you got to do it our way, which is really dumb. Because to me, like all these techniques we use in permaculture, as you said at the beginning of our interview, this is stuff everybody just used to know. Everybody just used to do this. But permaculture like ties all of them together. Is that what you mean when you say it's the missing link?
Yes, it was exactly. You know, and how to develop this piece of property in a way that functions. And how could you develop a piece of property and make it function any better than permaculture? You know, once you're introduced to it, you know, why in the world, you know, I just put out, in the beginning, I put a tree here or a tree there and a tree here. Oh, and I was trying to make them look pretty, you know, and, you know, okay, I plant an olive here and an olive here on the other side of the yard, and I plant, you know, a peach here and a peach here on the other side of the yard so that they would look pretty and uniform when it grew up. But that's not what it's about in reality, you know, to make things actually grow and do well. It's about building the soil. And what I'm doing here, I don't know if you saw my Facebook page, but I'm going in with thick cardboard, which I know there's pros and cons against the, you know, using cardboard, but I'm using almost 3/4 inch cardboard.
Wow.
I mean, it's some monster stuff. And then I'm going back over the top of it with 8 to 10 inches of mulch.
Mm.
And that's what I'm going to go in and put my trees in those mulch beds. And up here at the top, I've got two of them that are what I'm calling nursery beds. And what I plant in those beds, I'm going to propagate, or what I plant in those beds and does well, I'm planning on propagating and putting on the back 2 acres and doing the same thing, going in with large beds of mulch on contour and planting, you know, trees and shrubs in there and vines, and using the, you know, 7-layer permaculture system to do this whole thing so that it works synergetically. We're trying, you know, it's another thing that comes from Malcolm. Malcolm always talked about do like the forest. Try to recreate the forest. That's permaculture, man. He didn't know it.
Yeah.
When I mentioned permaculture to him this year, he said, "Oh heck yeah, I know about permaculture." And he said, "That stuff is great."
Yeah.
Nobody talks about it, or nobody's doing it.
Yeah.
And here in San Antonio, you know, I've called in. I'm a regular caller to my garden show. I come up with questions on purpose to be able to call in every now and then. And I try to stump Bob is what I try to do. You know, like, Gojis and Gumis grow here? And I kind of stumped him with that one. Mm-hmm. Hey, cool. You'd have to know Bob. I mean, for years, he just knows right off the top of his head. Just boom, 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 boom. He just knows.
I understand. There was a guy that did a show like that in Hot Springs when I used to live in Arkansas. And they actually had a thing where you could get free passes to the botanical gardens if you could call in. And it was almost like a dare, call in and stump him. So I remember one time I called and I said, "Yeah, what's hoogle culture?" There was this long, dramatic pause. And then he admitted, and I was waiting to hear him start spitting something out because it was such a long pause. I thought, he's got an assistant on the internet right now. And I was thinking, good luck spelling it.
Yeah. Well, and I don't do it to be mean to Bob. We don't do that to Bob. It's just it kind of gets him going, and he's honest about it. If he knows, because he knew about the goji berries, he figured they would work. The gumi he hadn't really heard of. You know, when I brought up permaculture to him, and permaculture is like he didn't really know about. Didn't really know about permaculture. You know, he said there's some books on it. Like, yeah, look at the price of, you know, Bill Wilson permaculture manual. It ain't cheap, Bubba.
Yeah.
It's not a cheap book. But, back to what, Malcolm said, and what goes along with what Bill Mollison says and goes along with permaculture and what Jeff Lawton says, we're recreating the forest.
Yeah, definitely. The forest is the teacher. It's interesting to me because I really don't know of Malcolm very much that he kind of had that same, try to do what the forest does. Because as soon as you said that, all I could think of is the similar quotes from Mollison and from Lawton. And I don't know, as a hunter, especially a deer hunter that hunted archery, I spent a lot of time in the forest. And the first time I ever heard that, my response wasn't like, oh, I knew that. It was more like, you dummy, how did you not ever figure that out for yourself? Because as soon as I heard it, I was, I think about all those hours sitting in a deer stand and watching all of this life proliferate around me with no one taking care of it. I'm like, all those years, you could have learned so much more if you would have thought about it that way instead of just watching squirrels and deer and turkeys. And it was kind of like, duh, God, you're dumb, right? There's times when you just think of yourself and you think, that was stupid. And I thought, okay, that was 20 years of dumb. But then you could also reflect back and think, oh, yeah. And it makes perfect sense to you. I think people that have spent any amount of time in the forest, when they hear that, they have that same conversion type experience. Like, yeah, okay, I get it.
Yep. Well, and you'll relate to this, the sponge, the forest floor sponge. If you walk on a forest floor, it's like walking on a sponge.
Absolutely.
And that's what, and I had the same epiphanies in listening to you, but I was relating to Malcolm Beck. I'm going, dadgummit, because Malcolm didn't, Malcolm didn't put it together in, he said, like the forest floor, put the mulch around your trees.
Yeah.
But it was around your trees. It wasn't like, hey, let's spread the mulch out and recreate the forest floor.
You know it's working is the places you've done things right. When it's dry, it's spongy. And when it's wet, it's spongy. The places you haven't got it there yet, when it's dry, you walk on it, it feels hard. And when it's wet, you walk on it, it feels like muck, right? So like the 3/4 acre food forest with the swales and all the stuff I've been working on 2 years, like even though we just got this tremendous amount of rain and the bottom of the swales are really mucky, you can walk through there and it's not disgusting. It's got this spongy bounce to it. But you go over to the areas where I haven't worked yet, and what you have is this slippery, slidey mud because you haven't built the structure in there yet to deal with that water. And what that means, of course, is the mucky stuff is going, even though it seems wetter right now, it's going to dry out a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You're exactly right. As long as we're on the mulch before we were just talking about compost and compost tea, something here recently that I discovered with my mulch is what Nick Ferguson calls duff. Mm-hmm. What I call it is the fines that are at the bottom of the trailer, that your fork doesn't get. And what I ended up doing is I shoveled those fines out and screened them through hardware cloth, 1/4 inch by 1/4 inch hardware cloth into even a finer material. And I was like, I want to see how many microbes are in this. Is what I ended up doing, just for the heck of it. I really didn't think there was going to be a lot of microbes, so let me preface where this mulch comes from. This mulch comes from my county recycling center that I get for free. It's the brush dump. And so it's brought, the local brush people bring it in, dump it. It sits out in the sun in Texas, August, July heat for weeks or months. Then it's run through this monster grinder, mechanical grinder, then it's put in a pile where it sits for weeks and months at a time until I went and got it, loaded onto my trailer, brought it home, unloaded most of it, got down to these fines, and like I said, sifted these fines out. And what I did to test this is I took like a gallon of water. Now I was thinking I was going to aerate it, so I got an aerator and an airstone, and I put it in there, and then I put a tablespoon of tablespoon of molasses and a tablespoon of seaweed in there, like I was going to make a quick brew of tea, thinking I was going to make whatever was in there, multiply a little bit in an hour, and just to see what it looked like. I put it in there. I let it sit for about 10 minutes, and I said, okay, I want to do a control. So I want to go check it now before I aerate it. Just basically let it kind of soak in and start it up so that the material actually got wet and integrated into the water or mixed into the water. Took a sample of it, put the three drops underneath my microscope, and the micro count was off the chart. I could not believe how many microbes were in that before I aerated it.
Wow.
You know, before it actually got fed. The amount of microbes in there is just unbelievable.
I have a theory as to why that would be the case, and it's why I've never had a problem using like large source stuff like municipal waste and all. Because it's sourced from so many places. So Mrs. Etheridge's trimmings from her dogwood tree are in there, and some guy down the road that cleared out a whole woodlot, his is in there, and the county went through and cut the stuff off the power poles, and there's this massive sourcing, and then it all gets mixed together, and you would think you'd end up with that diversity, which is what you said in the beginning, right?
It's all about the diversity. And as long as I'm throwing the diversity and then we're kind of on this track, something that I haven't heard anybody say, I did a post on Nick's new website about this, and I got comments everywhere but doing what I'm saying to do. And that is, at your functions or at anybody that's doing functions, I would suggest a compost exchange. A compost exchange meaning, you bring in a gallon of compost and somebody brings in 5 gallons of compost and whoever else brings in a gallon, and we intermingle all of this compost. Now, granted, somebody, might want to smell it, make sure it's not horrible.
Yeah.
Sort of stuff. And we mix this all together, and at the end of the event or before everybody goes home, whatever container that you brought, you fill back up and you take back home and do with as you please. Inoculate your compost pile, put it in your compost tea brewer and really kick it up and then put it on your compost pile and wherever else you want to put it. But to try to bring that diversity in as much as we can, it makes sense to me. I've posted it a couple of times. I actually posted it on Perma Ethos. And didn't get any bites. I posted it on Nick's and didn't get any bites. But to me, it makes sense. Why would we not want to bring as much diversity as we can? And it's just be a kind of a free, fun thing to do. Hey, man, bring some of your compost or go buy some from your local provider that you like.
Yeah.
And let's just, that we know is good compost, and let's all incorporate it together and we all take some of everybody's home. So we're all taking some of everybody else's microbes and fungi home.
I think it's a fantastic idea. I really do. I mean, because that's exactly what you're going to do. Then you're going to get this huge proliferation of different microbes. And could there be some in there that aren't, the best in the world? Sure. And there's probably some in every batch of compost that aren't the best in the world. But what you have is this huge diversity of some that are the best in the world. And that's pretty awesome. I think it's kind of the same thing that Michael Jordan talks about with if you're kind of a beekeeper that works with a lot of people, instead of trying to say this is your clover honey and this is your buckwheat honey or whatever, you take all of that local honey and you mix it together. So you've got this vast array of, and get more of everything that's great about honey. So it makes sense to me.
Yeah. And it's just a suggestion that people, you can take it for what you want. I think it's a good idea. I'm proposing it to you. You think it's a good idea. And when you're talking about microbes that may or may not be good for your area, if I'm not mistaken, Elaine Ingram basically said that if you have microbes that aren't from your area or aren't going to do well in your area, they're not going to survive in your area.
Yeah.
The thing about maybe bringing in bad microbes for your area, get over it. You can get off that bag of tricks.
I also would say, so there are certain legumes that are not indigenous to the United States, okay? And
they're indigenous to planet Earth.
Bacteria that they need to fix nitrogen is not indigenous to the United States. But when they were brought here, the rhizomial bacteria was brought along with them, and now they do wonderful in conjunction with that bacteria that's from Asia. So if that stuff can come from Asia and do well, then I'm pretty sure Florida and Georgia can mix some stuff up.
Yeah. And some of it will do well and some of it won't.
It'll figure itself out. I mean,
that's exactly.
Back to Mollison, right? I use 100% natives. They're all native to planet Earth.
They're all native to planet Earth. They're all native to planet Earth. Yeah, there's a guy. I don't know if you have ever heard of this guy. I can't remember his name now. Let me forget about it. No, Kirby Fry. Have you ever heard of Kirby Fry?
The name sounds familiar, but I couldn't tell you why right now.
He's a permaculturalist down here in Austin, and he's doing some really cool stuff. They're doing what's called perma blitzes, where people get together and perma blitz people's property, and it's a neat thing. I follow him on Facebook, his Facebook page, and he does some neat stuff. I don't know why I got to thinking about that, but I just his name came to mind and I forgot it, and then I remembered it, and now I don't know, I'm lost.
No, that's all right. Let's kind of talk about, because we're getting toward the end of this, some of the lessons you've learned. You've been on your property now 9 years, gardening, raising chickens and sheep. There has to be some stuff that's unique to that you've learned and gleaned from that experience.
The sheep, the Dorper sheep, if you're going to raise Dorper sheep, be prepared to have a bunch of Dorper sheep.
Okay.
They breed like rabbits.
Okay.
I have actually weaned mine down to where I'm down to none now, because I want to go ahead and put trees in back there, and I'm not even going to attempt to do it with the Dorpers back there, because it would have been fencing off every area and trying to, to keep them out, and just would have been too much of a pain. But I started off with 4 and ended up with 14 in a matter of about 4 years.
Wow.
And that was culling some, but not staying on top of the culling as fast as I should have, obviously. But they can get out of hand quick. Chickens, I'm a horrible chicken keeper. I let them free range around wherever they want to go on 2 acres. I only have at any given time about, 5 to 10 chickens. I just kind of keep them around for eggs and to peck around and for fertilizers. So, cause I'll take their manure and put it in my compost pile, and get their eggs. Something that I have definitely learned that I haven't really heard a lot about on your show is rabbits.
Okay.
The wild rabbits. They are wicked, evil, horrible creatures. You laugh because you know.
Yeah.
There's a couple of areas where I've planted small trees. I used to work at a treatment center up in Austin.
Yeah.
And I would bring home out of the gutters. I was doing maintenance, and I would bring home trees that would grow out of the gutter, just little bitty sprout trees.
Yeah.
And one area in particular, I put 4 of these little sprout trees in over the years. And I would come over there, and the dang thing would be just cut off.
Yeah.
Like somebody took a knife to it or a pair of clippers.
Yeah.
And I did it again, and it happened again. And I'm going, what in the world is going on? I mean, I started thinking that my neighbors were coming over here and sabotaging my trees. Well, why would they do that? Why would they care? Were they jealous of planting trees? It's just a little bitty tree.
Yeah.
No, it's rabbits. Rabbits do that. If you're growing the gojis, I don't know if you've had them get to your gojis, but they love gojis.
I have Shepherdess Maximus and Charlie Doggus, and if a rabbit is around for not very long, it ends up going up like a squirrel in a pink frothy spray in the air. So
yeah,
we don't have much rabbit problems. And the rabbits that we have around here, since they can't live on my property, they have to live off and come on. They have to be small enough to fit through a chain link fence, because in my property, they're not digging under. So any of them that get on the property are pretty little. You probably have cottontails and jackrabbits down there, and the jackrabbits are like cottontails on steroids.
I don't have jackrabbits, or I haven't seen them on my property. When I came in here, I fenced in basically like the house. And then the back of the yard is fenced in with, I fenced in cyclone around the house, and then field fencing in the back, and then the front of it is open. And so they're able to get in the back 2 acres, and in basically like the front, maybe quarter acre or 1 acre that's up here. And they are heck, man. They will tear stuff up. If you're putting in trees, especially little trees, and you even think you have cottontails around, I would strongly recommend putting some hardware cloth around the bottom of those trees.
Yeah.
I know, Stevon Sepovia, that's another thing. That permaculture orchard DVD is just choice. That is great information that he recommends, for other reasons, putting them around trees. But believe it or not, cottontails they come in and wreak havoc.
Yeah.
Like I said, my gojis, they've eaten my gojis down pretty much to the ground. And then I'll come back in. I saved them, luckily, by, putting the hardware cloth around them. to where they were able to come back up from the ground because they are a really hardy plant. But yeah, something else, you know, how you talk about cultivars of different plants. I planted this spring, I planted three avocado trees, three different cultivars. And two of those cultivars didn't make it. And one of them did. And if I would have only planted one of those cultivars that didn't make it, I would have been thinking I did something wrong. And they're planted in one of my quote-unquote nursery beds, and they're not 20 feet in any given direction away from each other, and they've been cared for and watered exactly the same the whole time, and two of them are not going to make it. They're just not. One of them is just as healthy as it can be, but they've been cared for exactly the same. So my point there is in how we talk, how you talk about growing these exotic things or these different things. If you can get different cultivars of that different thing, I would recommend getting, you know, multiple cultivars. Even though I lost $100, they were $50 trees. That's $150, and so $100 I lost, which I don't like, but I, you know, sorry, that's the way it goes. I can't do anything about it. They didn't like being here.
No, and I mean, that's just the way it is, and that's why I say I specialize in killing things. And after I kill enough things, there's enough living things left over that I know what lives, and that's the way it works sometimes. Sometimes it gets frustrating, but, you know, it is what it is. Not everything's going to do well where you are. Kind of on that note, kind of finishing up today, where are you on this journey, and what are kind of your goals going forward?
Where I'm at on this journey is to stop procrastinating on my PDC and finish my design.
Get it, man. I mean, we grade them pretty fast when you do.
Yeah, I just had to throw that in there because I'm procrastinating on it. But no, I'm planting more trees. I've got trees that are going to go in this fall. I'm going to buy some more trees. I'm jealous of your tree order that I saw on Facebook today that you got. I also started the microgreens. Actually business. I've actually did that in the past 2 months, or actually since I filled out the application to come on this show. Just this week in doing that, I went to seven different places. Of those seven, I got orders from five of them. And the other two are still interested, even though they didn't order right now, to throw that little wrench in the whole thing. So, you know, what I'm up to doing is a lot of what you're talking about, you know, people doing, getting off your stuff and doing it, you know, getting over, like you're talking about in your Reliance episode the other day, fear, quit being afraid and quit going, what if, and just do it, man. Just do something is my thinking.
Yeah. I completely agree with that. I feel like we don't get enough done in the world because of fear. That's like our biggest single hang up that we have as individuals is being afraid that it won't work. Well, you know, you can be afraid that it won't work and not do it, and I guarantee you it won't work. Or you can be afraid that it won't work and try it, and it might work. Those are really your only two choices with everything that you come up against in life.
Here, let me throw one thing off topic before we go on this topic any longer. A weed is nothing but a plant in the wrong place. Let me repeat that. A weed is nothing but a plant in the wrong place. I will credit Bob Webster for that, but I agree wholeheartedly with that statement.
Yeah, I think a variation I've heard on that is something like a weed is a plant that has mastered every skill other than growing in a straight line. You know?
That's too complicated, Elaine. A weed is nothing but a plant in the wrong place. It's a simple definition of what a weed is, and I agree with it. And I hear people all the time asking, what's a weed, da-da-da-da, on Facebook and even on your show. A weed, it's a plant in the wrong place. If you don't want it there, it's a weed. Get rid of it. If it's okay, if there's a reason to have it, have it. You know, keep it there. But in that regards. But the fear thing and just doing stuff, just getting up and doing stuff. Now, I'm in New Braunfels, Texas. I am not in a big foodie community like Austin, Texas is.
Sure.
You know, Austin's a big foodie community. And if I can go to 7 places in this little town and get orders from 5, those odds are just unbelievable. And it was just a matter of getting out there and trying it. I did a preliminary where I went around to like 4 places and they showed interest. And then I actually took samples out. And when I took the samples out, they were like, oh, wow, yeah, this is neat. And, you know, I got orders, you know, from 5 out of 7. And the other 2 are interested, but it may not be, it's just not today they weren't interested or yesterday they weren't interested. You know, so it's just a matter of doing it. You know, the other thing, you know, like when I had my permaculture business, and how people judge failure is really, I think, kind of messed up, or at least in my experience it is everybody judges failure on monetary. You know, how much money did you make? Well, how much money does it take to not be a failure? I made money with my compost tea business. I didn't make $1 million with my compost tea business. So I was a failure at my compost tea business? No, I was not. I made money. I made contacts. I learned a lot about what, you know, about soil. You know, the knowledge is priceless. And so how can I say that I was a failure? I won't say that I wasn't a failure. There was, you know, the opportunity that I got to put it on grass fields or grass, you know, grass growers fields in South Texas. And had I have gotten that, it would have turned into a $1 million industry. The man didn't want to do it. I came up putting compost tea again up against the most potent fertilizers that they have known to man to grow grass. And I came up 2 weeks short, in his opinion. To me, that was a win.
Yeah.
You know, he just didn't want to use the compost tea because, you know, look at all his buddies that are going to go out of business and he quits buying their fertilizer.
Yeah, definitely.
It's, you know, so I don't think that I lost. I just don't think I didn't get it. I didn't lose. I learned from it. I learned that I can make my compost tea compete with the best chemicals out there. And I'm 2 weeks short. And in the long run, that 2 weeks would have turned around and it would have gotten to where it would have at least caught up, if not done better, because of the rebuilding of the soil over time. It, you know, but to explain that to him, I'm just not that good of a salesman. I ain't Jack Spirico, man. I couldn't tell him.
Well, you also ain't done yet either. I mean, you it's up to you now where you go from here. And I think that a lot of times people, like, they try something and if it doesn't really work, you know, completely the way they envisioned right away, they call it a failure, and it's just a step. And
exactly,
you took a step that most people will never take. You gave it a shot, and you know, it's kind of up to you to decide where you want to go with it next.
Well, it's like the, you know, the microgreens. I've gone through 3 different growing mediums as far as growing the microgreens. I went with the soil, like everybody talked about. Yeah, this is pretty cool. What, you know, what can we do? Then I went to cocoa medium. Hey, this is cool. It's light, you know, costs less, you know, neat deal. It's a renewable product. I like it. Then I got turned on to the rock wool and went, this is interesting because I like the presentation of the rock wool. Well, all you have to do is, you know, take, you know, your 8x8 or 10x10 or whatever square of rock wool that you have, and that's what you pick up and you take to the restaurant. Because rock wool is a product that's heated up, it's rock that's heated up to 1200 degrees and spun out like cotton candy, is a definition that I got off of their website. And so it's totally sanitary, and you can present it to the chef just like that. He can clip it as he wants it. It eliminates me having to package it. It eliminates me having to cut it. It eliminates me having to wash it. I like this. And that's what I took around to these restaurants, and every one of them liked it. Every one of them liked that presentation.
And I think what's really, like, more important to understand about that is, so, like, you found that the chefs that you were selling microgreens to liked you to bring in uncut microgreens that they could cut as they need. Where I've talked to some microgreen growers that have said they've actually found the opposite to be true because, you know, they're worried that a sous chef's going to set something on top of it and smash it or set it down in blood, chicken blood or something. So it's dependent on the restaurant, the chef, the way they run the restaurant, their personal preferences. And that means that
there's opportunity for everybody to find what is the home run in their backyard, so to speak.
Exactly. Well, and there's just reason I like it. Once you cut it, you know, you have the potential of it to start browning, or once you cut it, it's going to start rotting, period.
Yeah.
You know, you start to rot. So the longevity of the product is there by not cutting it. You're getting it fresher. If in health-wise, as far as your micronutrients and, you know, all the vitamins and the good stuff that are in these microgreens, they start diminishing as soon as you cut it. Whereas if you're eating it for the health purposes, the best way to use it is as soon as you cut it, instead of waiting for days or a week, however long it takes you to use it. You know, and one bad bunch, you know, or one bad apple spoils the bunch. So once you have one stem that's starting to rot, well, it's going to affect the whole batch of it. You know, I saw that in one of the restaurants the other day where, you know, it's, you know, they're starting to brown on the bottom where they had cut them. And I guarantee you in 2 days, that's going to be up higher, and that's less product that they have to serve because it's diminishing from the bottom or from that cut up. And the longer it takes them to serve it, the less of it there's going to be there to serve.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's my little, I didn't even have that on my app. Like I said, I hadn't even started it yet.
Yeah. Well, that means you're doing stuff. That's what that means.
Yeah. And you asked me what I'm doing, and that's what I'm doing. You know, and here's the, I got a kicker, man. I put in my application for my farmer's market, and in listening to you guys or listening to your show, people, you know, may have got the same perception that I did, like going to a farmer's market is easy, or getting into a farmer's market is easy. I'm finding that to not be the case.
Hmm.
And get this, Jack. Here was my presentation. I'm going to have microgreens every single week. 56 weeks a year, I can have my microgreens at my booth every week. Here's my value add. Right now, I got Meyer's lemons that are getting ready to come ripe. Mm-hmm. In another couple of weeks, I'll have Meyer's lemons at my booth. At different times of the year, I have peaches. At other times of the year, I have apples. At other times of the year, I have plums. That was going to be my value add to my booth. Because my thinking in that regards is, you know, I can have my peaches fail or my plums fail or any of my fruit trees fail, to make a long story short. But every week, I'm going to be here with microgreens. Every week, it'll be there. I can't get in my local farmer's market.
Huh.
I can't. And that was my sell. That was my pitch. And they either, my dad says they're slow walking me. I don't know. We don't know why, but either they don't have room or they're saying they don't have room or whatever. Basically, they haven't called me back to say, hey, you can come to the farmer's market.
Yeah.
But in one of the places that I got turned on to this weekend with my microgreens is actually a little farmer's market that I didn't even know was out here. And I'm going to be taking him microgreens, and he wants my lemons. Hey, cool. Yeah. Hey, whenever peaches come ripe, guess where they're going to be going or who's going to have an opportunity to get them. Well,
I think that's the key, is to continue to plug along and continue to look for success, even when you have some doors not open for you. But that sounds like a bit of gilding there in the most inappropriate way, that, you know, keeping the competition out, so to speak, because this is what I've seen with some farmers markets. And I'm not saying what's going on there because I don't know. I'm not from there. But I've seen some markets that are relatively small. And because of that, they have small attendance from buyers. So because of that, all of the people in the farmers markets are scrambling for the business they can get. But because they're so small and they lack diversity and choice, the clientele doesn't grow. So their solution is to, well, we'll limit the number of vendors, which is the very thing that's keeping more people from coming, because that's exactly, now I don't know if it was hard to get in, but that's exactly what the problem with the Hot Springs farmers market was. It was like, there's like 20 booths. It was like two I even care to visit. And so I'm not going to go very often. Where I've been, yeah, some big farmers markets where there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people there selling their stuff. And yeah, there's some repetition, but you walk through and you have this ability to, you know, have this huge palette of choices every week and learn something new every week. And those are worth going to. And I think that there's this inverse problem where
well, we got to keep out from having too many vendors so that everybody that's here can at least sell enough to make it worth doing. Well, you'll never grow your client base that way. You just won't.
Well, and there's not another microgreen grower there.
Yeah.
They're just, they're not, they don't even offer the product.
In the mind of the protectionist, it's still a competing vendor. You know, that's what I'm thinking. But anyway,
you might be right. Yeah, and you could be right. And that, because I mean, what's your opinion? I thought I presented that well.
No, I think you did. I think that's exactly what it is, that they would have said no to, you know, anybody. That's
yeah, I mean, I could have walked in there saying I'm giving away gold, possibly, and they say no, right?
No, yeah.
I'm going to be giving away gold. And I go, no, we can't have you here. You'll be too much competition.
yeah.
type of thing. That's cool.
Anyway, let's go ahead and wrap up there. You want to give people any final thoughts on, you know, just the concept of getting things done and starting somewhere?
Just do it. Just do it. That's the thing. You got to try it. You know, like I talked about Bob Webster and you mentioned killing plants. You know, Bob Webster swears, you know, call me and ask me the question about the plant because I've killed thousands of them. And that's how I know. And so, you know, if you do something and it doesn't work, don't get down, because I know I do. I get down. I want to go cry over my poor little olive trees, because I, or not olive, my avocado trees, because it's like, oh man, guys, what did I do?
Yeah.
And I'll go back to it. I wouldn't have known that I didn't do anything wrong, because I'm still going to say I didn't do anything wrong because one of them worked when I did the same thing to all three of them. You know, and just don't quit. And like you talk about all the time, do it. You know, actually do it. You know, stop thinking about it and do it. And that's just the way it's got to be. You just got to do it. And it's hard. It's hard to get motivated at times to do it. You know, like I told you before the show, I've been dealing with stuff. And it's hard to get motivated. But you just got to do it, man. You just got to do it. And it's worth trying. You know, like the microgreens, it's worth trying.
Yeah.
It ain't going to hurt. Because I'm not in a very big town. You know, I've got other little towns that I'm going to go to. If I keep getting that kind of reception, hey, I'm on to something. You know, and it's just a matter of trying it. And then I didn't have any idea of what I could do with my, you know, my surplus of my fruit, because the farmer's market won't have me, is what I'm going to say for now. Okay, they won't have me. Oh, poor me. Yeah, get off the factory. But hey, look what happens. I end up finding a farmer's market, an individual owns, that I didn't even know was out there. And here you go. And so you don't know, you don't even know what's out there until you try, because you don't know what's out there.
Yeah. That's the key. You don't know what you don't know.
And here's the other thing that really surprised me with the microgreens is that every restaurant sent me to another restaurant or wanted to make sure that I went to this restaurant. I didn't think that was going to be the case. I kind of figured, hey, you know, I'm going to be kind of, you know, we're going to do this under the table, right? You're going to be like my secret microgreen grower, right? No. Yeah. They're all about, hey, you need to go talk to Joe over here, or you need to go talk to this guy at this restaurant, or have you been here yet? Every single one of them has been that way. And that's just amazing to me. There wasn't any selfishness in it. And as far as a horrible, mean, wicked chef like Dave Ramsey on yelling, yeah. No. I got one lady that sat down with me, brought up her spreadsheet, what she pays for her product, and we're running a test. You know, I know exactly what I'm up against, and she wants mine to work.
Wow.
You know.
Great.
It's really cool.
Well,
and
you are
get
in South Central.
People.
You know, you are in South Central Texas. You're not in yuppie land up in, you know, Connecticut or something like that. I don't think that. I think first of all, the Gordon Ramsays of the world are, you know, on TV are accentuated, but there is some of that prima donna thing in the chef world. But that just don't play in Texas. You don't talk to people like that in Texas. You don't treat people like that in Texas. You know,
yep.
I don't care if you're the boss or whatever. This state's a little bit different, as you know, as a long-term, you know, member of the Republic of Texas, so to speak. We treat people a little bit differently here, and if you don't, you kind of wish you did.
Yeah, you kind of wish you did.
<That's>
welcome to Texas.
Just
welcome
right
to Texas.
There.
Yeah, welcome to Texas. Well, and that's, you know, in closing, you know, one thing I would like to tell people or in the audience, be nice to each other. Let's stop hating on each other, man. You know, they've got it. They got us wanting to hate each other so bad. Let's stop it. Let's just be nice. I ain't saying love everybody. I ain't getting into no John Lennon trip. You know, let's all get funky and, you know, do acid and trip out together and have a good time. Just be nice to people. Quit, you know, everybody just stop being mean. Stop having, don't let your cruddy attitude reflect on the person that you're talking to across the counter or doing business with or in the vehicle next to you. Just be nice, man. Just be nice. Why not? You will feel better and they will feel better. Just be nice. Hey, wave at a cop sometime. It's hilarious. I love it. I love waving at cops, watching them go all chicken neck on. Oh, it's fun. Yeah. But just be nice. Just be nice to people, man. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They do. They freak out when you wave at them. But because I wave at people all the time, just driving down the road. I'm trying to bring back that old country road sort of thing. I got a couple of small roads around here, and if I'm on them, I'm waving at you. If you're a cop or not, I don't care. I'm waving at you. Well, you wave back, I don't care. It's like, hey, I'm trying to you know, give forward, as they say.
Cool, man.
But just, you know, there's no reason to not be nice. There's really not.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up there. I thank you for being on the air with us today, Rod.
Thank you. Hey, if anybody wants to look me up on Facebook, I'm Rod Woods on Facebook. You're more than welcome to look at me on Facebook. Yeah, I'm cool with that.
I'll put a link in today's show notes. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Rod Woods, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
Hey there, mister. Can you tell me what happened to the seeds I've sown? Can you give me a reason, sir, as to why they've never grown? They just blown around from town to town till they're back out on these fields. Yeah, where they fell for a mad hand back into the dirt of this hard land. Come on. I'm here, my sister. From Germantown, yeah, we did right. Well, we made our best, sir. From the rock on the mountainside, we've been blown around from town to town, looking for a place of land where the sun bursts through the clouds to fall like a circle of fire down on this hard land. Just one.